You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. We are streamed on the internet at khen.org, and if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any of the past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, as a professor of geography at California State University Stanislaus. With nearly 30 years of teaching experience, his academic research has focused on using soils and landforms and as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And we also have a special guest, Chuck Rose, who's the mayor of Salida, Colorado, and he's going to be participating with our discussion here. And our guest is Dr. Tim Ball, and he's a Canadian environmental consultant and former professor of geography at the University of Winnipeg, where he specialized in the relation of climate to human settlement. He disputes that humans have a significant impact on climate change and heads a natural resources stewardship program and is on the scientific advisory board of Friends of Science organizations that reject the likelihood of human-caused global warming. And he has a BA degree from the University of Winnipeg and a master's degree from the University of Manitoba in 1970 in geography and a PhD degree in geography from the University of London, England in 1983, writing a thesis analyzing historical weather records from Canada's north. Tim Ball has taught geography at the University of Winnipeg from 1988 to 1996, starting as a sessional lecturer and retiring as a professor. Do you have anything else to add to that, Dr. Ball?
Sorry, I missed that.
Do you have anything else you would like to add?
Well, I did almost 9 years in the Canadian Air Force, and five of that was search and rescue in the Arctic, which was an incredible experience.
That sounds interesting in its own right.
Yes.
And Dr. Carlstrom, would you like to go ahead and get started with the interview?
Yeah, certainly. Welcome back, Dr. Tim Ball. We've had the chance to interview you three times now, and the three previous interviews are on Melody's website, on our archived website. And the quality of those interviews is very good, and I've actually had some of my students listen to them as an assignment. So it's a pleasure to have you back. And I think the best, and before I jump into the questioning, I'll just note that you have been connected with geography departments. I've been connected with geography departments here in the United States as well as Canada, where I got my PhD. And I feel like geography is somewhat center stage. Should be somewhat center stage in these debates, although I think oftentimes it is not. But let me go ahead and launch off. We had our last interview, I believe, last fall before the December Copenhagen international meeting, which was a very important meeting to try, or where the governments of the world tried to come together to form some kind of a climate treaty. And we know that there were black bloc demonstrators a thousandfold in the streets of Copenhagen and that it was somewhat of a dramatic event. Could you give us your assessment of what the results, the upshot of that conference is for us, where the issue is now as a result of that conference?
Yeah, okay, and I'd also like to preface my comments, first of all, to the mayor. I'm a very firm believer that the real politics is at the municipal and lower level, just like with newspapers. It's the local newspaper that's directly accountable to the people, and I commend the mayor for at least being willing to come and listen. In my experience with politicians, especially at the higher levels, is that they don't even want to listen to the debate. And part of the proof of that is 60 of us signed a letter to the Canadian Prime Minister simply asking for a debate. So I really commend the mayor for his willingness to be here today. With regard to your comment on geography, Eric, yes, geography is the original integrative discipline. Technical term is chorology, the study of integrating things, but it is very appropriate for the study of climate, because one of the difficulties that we've got with the whole issue of weather and climate is that we're in a world that is increasingly specialized, and climate is a very generalist discipline. Climate is made up of the weather, which of course is what you experience every day, and climate is the average of that. But the weather is everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to what the sun is doing to what's happening on the bottom of the oceans with geothermal heat and everything in between. And this is why it's so difficult for the public to understand, because there are so many specialists all standing up with their own little piece of the puzzle. And the analogy I use with climate is that every specialist got a piece of the puzzle, but we've lost the box top. And in geography, of course, what we're constantly trying to do is to recreate the total picture, the integrated picture. But, of course, that's become unacceptable in today's academic world, that the dictum has shifted from, and I'm sure the mayor would relate to this, from there were general rules with exceptions to the rule. Now what we have is there are no general rules and everything is an exception, and it's why people are having a hard time grasping what's going on. With regard to the climate puzzle, and use that analogy, we still haven't found and identified the four corner pieces of the puzzle, which is fundamental to making a puzzle, let alone all of the edge pieces. And, of course, this is why, as I said, they've been able to, say, focus on CO2, which is one incredibly small part of the total complexity that is weather and climate. Now, of course, out of all of this came the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and, of course, Copenhagen was, and from that came Kyoto. And Copenhagen was simply a continuation of Kyoto. Kyoto, the first meeting in Berlin was COP1, that is the conference of the parties, and Copenhagen was COP15. And these people have been flying all over the world to very exotic places and meeting to continue this whole idea that somehow humans are causing global warming and now climate change. And of course, it was in serious trouble. And that was part of why Copenhagen became such a major focus, particularly with bringing in the heavyweight hitters. President Obama flying in, he was going to be an introductory speaker. He ended up basically being the cleanup hitter to try and give it some gravitas. Prior to Copenhagen, it was seriously undermined by leakage of information, of emails from major players in climate science who are based at the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia. And I had the privilege of working with the founder of that unit, Hubert Lam, when I was doing my doctoral thesis. And I'm sure he'd be turning in his grave at what has happened at that institute with regard to corruption of science. And it's very clear that leaking of the emails occurred to undermine to try and expose what was going on and what Copenhagen was based on. And there's no doubt in my mind that it was an insider, because the selection of the emails that were released, the selection of the computer codes that were released, the fact that you had to know secure computer codes within the university to have access to the data, and the fact that the data was released to a BBC reporter 5 weeks before it went out through a Russian internet site, And that was clearly done hoping that the BBC reporter would use the international scope of the BBC to expose what had gone on with climate science. That clearly had a huge impact upon Copenhagen, and as I say, it was clearly designed for that purpose. So Copenhagen was an attempt to continue the Kyoto, but particularly one part of it, and that is the cap and trade, which emerged from the original Kyoto idea of carbon credits. And that has evolved into a money-making prospect for politicians, the carbon taxes, and also, of course, control of industries and so on. And so Copenhagen really didn't achieve anything at all. It was a continuation. They're now in the process of preparing the next IPCC report, and Copenhagen said, well, we're here and we're going to continue meeting, but basically we met and we agreed to meet again, and that's essentially the outcome. And of course, what's happened since Copenhagen is more and more of the corruption of the IPCC and the CRU, and they are the same people. The people that are were exposed in the emails at the CRU control the major chapters of the IPCC reports.
The CRU and, being the Climate Research Unit at East Anglia University.
At East Anglia. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And incidentally, Phil Jones, who's the director, who's now stepped aside, Tom Wigley, who was the former director of CRU, both of them were at Villach, Austria in 1985, when Maurice Strong set up the IPCC. So they've been involved in its organization from the very start and have controlled the key chapters in those reports. They controlled the chapter on atmospheric chemistry, which of course means the CO2 and so on. They've controlled the chapter that relates to your interest, Eric, and that is paleoclimates, reconstruction of past climates. They controlled the critical chapter on computer models, which are, of course, the basis of all of the prognostications for the future. And they also controlled the summary for policymakers, which is a bizarre report that is given out to the media and the public before the actual science report is released. And the summary is written by selected bureaucrats and politicians with only two or three scientists guiding them. And it's always been people from CRU that have been the scientists advising the preparation of the summary for policymakers. It then goes back, after it's been released to the media, it then goes back to the scientist who prepared the science report and said, look, make sure your science report agrees with what we've now released in the summary, which is most bizarre way of functioning, but a measure of the politics of the whole issue. And so that's basically where we're sitting right now. And as I say, we're going to see more and more exposure of the corruption of the science.
I have a couple comments here, Tim. One is that the Kyoto Protocol, which, of course, was signed by some, I think, 100 nations, wasn't it, back in the 1990s, had two phases in mind. Phase one would be to lower our carbon emissions to a certain level. Phase two, which would kick in, I think, around 2050, would reduce our carbon emissions to 20% of what they were in 1990. We hear, in fact, Gordon Brown making pledges that England wants to do that, and Obama making pledges that he wants to do that. And a lot of people say that if we were to do that, unless we have energy alternatives online, we don't have any now, this would bring us back to third world country status. So these are fairly major targets that would require the major overhaul of society and perhaps to some extent the deindustrialization of the society.
Doesn't that also fit in with what Maurice Strong said back in the 90s?
Right. That was his intent, yes.
Yes, that was the intent. And by the way, it started earlier than that. Maurice Strong was a member of the Club of Rome. And, of course, the book that they're well-known, well, two, one is Paul Ehrlich's book on the population, and that's another issue behind this, that the world's overpopulated, which is simply not true. But the other is that to get rid of the industrialized nations. And there's a quite remarkable quote from a second book that the Club of Rome produced in 1974, and it's it was called Mankind at the Turning Point, and in that they make the statement: it would seem that humans need a common motivation. Now, the mayor would be familiar with this: that you need something to focus people's attention, to get their attention, to get things going. And it's sort of like the idea that one way to unify the world in peace would be to have a threat of an invasion from Mars. And the old idea that the enemy of my enemy. And so they said, it would seem that humans need a common motivation. And here's the most frightening comment, either a real one or else one invented for the purpose. In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. Well, we're hearing about the water shortages and so on. But what they were doing was using the threat of global warming as the vehicle pursue Maurice Strong's statement that the problem for the planet are the industrialized nations, and isn't it our responsibility to get rid of them? But before we go any further, just for the mayor's edification, I want him to understand that the issue isn't global warming. The issue isn't climate change. Global warming has occurred. It depends on what period of the record you want to pick. The most significant warming recently has been from 1680, which was called the Little Ice Age. And you go and look at the conditions that Washington faced in 1770 when it was still cold. And it's warmed up since then. There's no debate about that. The issue is what was the cause, and the argument is made that the cause was CO2, and what those of us that disagree with that are saying, well, look, you're ignoring natural causes, particularly the sun and other mechanisms that create climate change. So, and the argument, though, well, the climate change, that somehow this is something new, is also nonsense. The climate changes dramatically all of the time, and it always has and it always will. And the climate change that we're experiencing now is well within natural climate variability of any period in history that you want to look at. So that's really the issue. And so what we're talking about now is why the focus became CO2. It's a bit like if you consider, say, weather, when you stand outside, I've already talked about all the complexities you experience. So if you consider the weather like your body or my body or whatever, and a specialist or a doctor is going to look at it and say, well, I'm going to study this person, but I'm only going to look at one small wart on the left arm. That's effectively what they're doing with their studies of the weather and the climate. They've focused on CO2, which is, it's not even the most important greenhouse gas. It's less than 4% of the greenhouse gases. Water vapor is 95% by volume, but it hardly gets talked about. And so the question that really needs to be asked and understood is, why did they focus on CO2? And of course, if you're going to achieve Maurice Strong's objective of shutting down industrialized nations, then the way that you do it is if you consider the industrialized nations like the engine of a car, and that's a good analogy because they run on fossil fuels, you can stop the energy flow to the engine and it will stop. But if you did that, it would be political dynamite. The public would scream right away, and we saw that with the recent increase in gasoline prices, how quickly the public were out yelling. But if you could show that the byproduct of that engine or that industrialized nation was destroying the climate and destroying the planet, then you could effectively shut down the engine in the same way that you can stop a car engine by plugging the exhaust. So that's the analogy there, and that's why CO2 became the focus. And of course, then and as a politician, Mr. Mayor, you would know that one of the this is from my own experience, having served on commissions of inquiry and chaired commissions of inquiry. Commissions of inquiry are a very nice political vehicle if the heat gets too great. That you can step aside and say, well, look, we'll have an independent inquiry, and then of course you don't have to answer questions because you say, well, I can't say anything until the inquiry's finished. But when I was appointed to the first commission of inquiry, and it was a conflict over water, which, as the mayor would know, it can be pretty hostile and confrontational issue. We got the terms of reference, and I realized then how the minister in charge was retaining control, because the terms of reference limited so much of what we were allowed to look at. We couldn't even come up with an answer to the problem because of the restrictions of the terms of reference. Well, the point I'm making here is that Maurice Strong wrote the terms of reference for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And in doing that, he controlled and directed what they would look at. For example, he defined climate change as only those changes in climate caused by human activity, which effectively meant that they weren't going to look at natural variability or natural causes at all. And then that summary for policymakers, that bizarre procedure of doing the executive summary and then going back and making sure the report agrees with it, that was also written into the terms of reference for the IPCC. And of course, that's why they were able to focus on CO2 and make it the center of everything. And of course, then it was put into practice through the Kyoto Accord. Now, Maurice Strong, once he'd set up the IPCC and got the scientific side of it controlled, he then organized in 1992 the Rio Conference, where he took the whole project into the NGOs and the public arena. And, of course, it was interesting that George Bush Sr. refused to go to that conference, saying it was just simply a politically rigged conference. But at that conference, of course, all of the environmental groups became involved and the NGOs became involved, but it was out of the 1992 Rio conference that the Kyoto Accord was started. And of course, Kyoto, as Eric said, involved most of the nations of the world. I think the actual number, Eric, was 154, but the vast majority of them, although they signed on to the accord, were not required to implement any reduction in CO2 levels at all. They were put into the countries of the world were classified into Annex 1 countries, which were developing or developed countries, I should say, and then there were Annex 2 countries, which were the developing countries, and that the reduction of CO2 was only going to be applied to the Annex 1 countries. And what would then happen, and of course this is part of Maurice Strong and his socialist background, was that those developed countries were going to be punished for their development and their growth and their wealth at the expense of the world and everybody else. And that surplus money was then going to be paid through carbon credits to the developing nation.
Where does China come in that? Where does China come into this? Are they considered developing?
Well, that's the interesting problem, because you see, when China was originally developing, China was going to get payments from the developed countries because they were considered developing. But in the interim, China has just absolutely boomed. They're now the fourth largest GDP in the world. India, similarly, was classified as developing. They're now the 13th largest GDP in the world. And they're not required to meet any of the Kyoto requirements or to reduce CO2 at all. And yet they're also expecting to get paid by the other countries. And the U.S., for example, it's a percentage of GDP that they have to pay. I think it's something like $91 billion that the U.S. has got to fork out as its payment for being a developed nation. And so because of the change in world economies since Kyoto was implemented, it's just become a farce. And of course, what's ending up happening is those countries who are moving ahead, taking advantage, and not being required to meet any of these restrictions, are gaining every which way. And so it where it was originally supposedly creating a level playing field, has done exactly the opposite. And what you had at Copenhagen, for example, was that the developing nations, particularly the African nations, were saying, look, you're trying to wriggle out of your commitment to give us this money that you promised us for the damage that you've done to the world climate. And that was another great contentious issue at Copenhagen. And so I don't know where it's going to go from here. I mean, China and India all along have said they're not going to participate. And by the way, I have worked with Chinese climatologists and also with Indian climatologists, and I know that they understand the science extremely well. My work with the Chinese climatologists was looking at increasing food production in colder climates of northern China, and they are very, very well versed in the climate science. So what's created? And by the way, the carbon credits is another thing we need to talk about briefly. The carbon credits was introduced as an enticement to try and get the U.S. to sign the Kyoto Accord, because the U.S. Government said they were not going to sign it. And in fact, when it went before the U.S. Senate, the vote was 95-0. Against signing the Kyoto Accord. And that was when Al Gore was the vice president. And the reason given, of course, was that it would seriously impinge and inhibit the economy and cost jobs. And, of course, that's turned out to be the case. Anywhere in a country where they've tried to implement some of these things, like Spain, for example. And so what happened was that those supporters of Kyoto said to the American government, well, what would you need? What changes would you like us to make in order for you to sign on to Kyoto? And the American government came back and said, look, okay, we'll acknowledge that we're producing CO2, and but we're also, in our activities, removing CO2 from the atmosphere. And most people don't know this, but 50% of the CO2 that humans produce is removed from the atmosphere by agriculture, the crops that we grow, so that the net amount that we're putting up is half of what is the actual output. And then, of course, you add to that forestry, and the forested areas in the U.S. have increased 30% in the last 100 years. There's more forest in the U.S. now than there was at the end of the 19th century. And so they said, we want some credits for that. But it didn't change anything. As I say, the vote was 95-0 against it anyway. But the idea of carbon credits didn't die, because it was seen as a potential for making money. And there was a meeting in the White House in 1998 between Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Lord Brown of British Petroleum, who became one of the biggest players in alternate energies and carbon credits. But the fourth person at that meeting was Ken Lay. And Ken Lay, of course, was the CEO of Enron. And what they talked about there and set up was a strategy for carbon credit markets. And, of course, Enron then went and implemented its plan in California. And the major reason for California's total monetary problems can be traced back to that. The environmental policies of not progressing with and increasing the amount of energy required, trying to produce it through alternate energies which simply don't work. And that's the fundamental reason why California is in the problem that it's in now.
Well, deregulation of the energy market, which was achieved by two previous Republican administration, set the stage for what Enron pulled off.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No question about it. Yeah, there's a lot of blame to go around here. And so the carbon credits, of course, then one of the things that you see with this whole climate issue is what I call the moving of the goalposts. I mean, one of the major ones was that they used to talk about global warming, and then it suddenly became climate change. And the reason for that was, of course, that starting in 2002, global temperatures started to decline, but CO2 levels continued to increase, which, of course, completely contradicted what they were claiming must happen. And so it suddenly became climate change, and that then they could attribute everything to it. For example, I've just read this morning where there's scientists and politicians, they go, the snowstorms in Washington are due to global warming, which is so illogical that even people that don't understand the science are shaking their heads.
So, gentlemen, firstly, I'd like to thank you both for considering me a politician. But in the act of listening to this, what I think I could be better characterized as is an interested citizen trying to parse the variety of information that bombards us. Right away, I'm reminded of the fact that Jefferson was wrong. He expected, being a man of the Enlightenment, that we would hear the arguments in a cold, calculated way and be able to make a logical decision, which, of course, ignored the fact that we're humans, and the result being emotion enters into almost every discussion. I'm also reminded of Eisenhower's last address, where it was specifically beware of the military-industrial complex, but the bigger picture was, once you let the money of the military-industrial complex into the schools, your research will be skewed, because that's the money that will fund the universities. And it really becomes a challenge for those of us who have an interest and pay attention to the science, because of the degree of politics that's involved, and it's not just politicians, the scientists as well, obviously. And I think the free market aspect of it, when we have our largest, most powerful companies hiring people, even if it is an impartial science, it can't appear that way when you're getting paid by Exxon or Mobil or one of those groups. So what would be helpful to me would be to find the impartial observer and opinionator, I guess, something that I thought we had in the 60s, but I was probably fooling myself, to boil this stuff down into things that are understandable but less emotional. As a politician, the challenge is you get bombarded with all this stuff, and how do you make a decision? And I will tell you my view as it exists. Firstly, we're a town of 5,500, and even though it's the same size of Wasilla when Sarah Palin was mayor, I'm not as good looking as she is, and I guarantee you I will not run for vice president. But we do not deal in the climate issue in a big picture. But if you want something more valuable than water in the Intermountain West, or more valuable than the climate change issue, it's water. And so to that degree, we deal with it, although we're dealing with it further down the discussion. But when I listen to the climate change debate, as a politician and as a citizen of the world, I say to myself, well, perhaps the scientists are wrong. Perhaps it is not human causes what's purported to be a rapid heat up. But what is wrong with slowing the use or reducing the emissions just in case? The analogy I use is, if I'm a good driver, I'm looking down the road a half mile or a mile and I see someone in my lane, it's better to assume they're going to stay in my lane and I need to make evasive action than to wait for the impact. So my question to you, gentlemen, really is, how does a semi-intelligent, in spite of the fact that I am a politician for a small portion of my life here, but a semi-intelligent observer figure out what arguments are so off the scale that they shouldn't be listened to, and which observers really are offering us some information that would give us some logical data to make our own decision?
Yeah, it can. very, very perceptive comments, Mr. Mayor, and I've dealt with and tried to help politicians and work with politicians. But your point is very well taken. First of all, by the way, I will agree with you about water. One of the things that I learned very quickly in my studying of climate was that the most devastating climate event are droughts. If you look, there was a list made of the 20 worst climate disasters of the 20th century, and 11 of the top 20 were droughts. I mean, we're talking droughts in China in the 30s when 300,000, 400,000 people died. And I also have worked with farmers across North America dealing with droughts and weather conditions and so on. So I would agree. I also happen to think that whole NAFTA was about water because we already had 80% free trade with the U.S. anyway. In fact, there's more free trade between Canada and the U.S. than there is between Canadian provinces, and also the fact that Canada has about 30% of the world's fresh water. So I would agree with you totally on that. With regard to your question about, and in a sense, it's a question about priorities, I believe. Many years ago, I was approached by the people in Ottawa who were trying to make policy with regard to the sorts of things you're talking about. And they were talking about what they called the three E's. And the three E's were energy, economy, and environment. And, of course, those have become the ones that are can be in conflict. And that's part of what this whole debate has been about. And their difficulty was that they said, look, we can get some handle on the energy issue, we can get some handle on the economy issue, but when we start to look at the environmental issue, and particularly the climate, the science is so confusing and so contradictory, we don't know where to go with it. And my response, and it was part of a seminar that I held with them in Ottawa, was, look, what you do is you acknowledge all three, but surely it makes sense to save energy. And surely it makes sense to save money. And if in the as a byproduct of that, it also benefits the environment, then that's the way to go. Now, what's been happening, of course, is that it's been being done the other way around, that the environment is at the top of the list, that nothing happens to energy or economy unless you put the environment at the top of the list. And that's the difficulty I personally have had, and I know talking with a lot of politicians had. And part of this, of course, is the exploitation not only of fear by the alarmists, the climate alarmists, but also the lack of knowledge of climate and climate science. I mean, some of the things I probably mentioned here this morning that you wouldn't have been aware of. And those exploitations of those things and so trying to work through that and make political decisions, I agree with you. It's very, very difficult. But one of the things that the public are angry about, and I've spoken all over the world in phone-in radio programs or in public presentations, what's happened is environmentalism came in as a concept, very necessary, absolutely the new paradigm that we needed to have, and you talked about exploitations and industries and so on. We needed environmentalism. But what happened was that, as with any new idea, people were saying, well, how much of this do we adopt? How far do we go with this? And there was really no understanding. And but what happened was that it got hijacked by small groups of extremists, and they took the moral high ground with it. And from that moral high ground, they bullied everybody, including the politicians, into silence. And the minute you say anything, for example, you know, I'm the devil incarnate for even daring to question some of the science, and you get, oh, well, you don't care about the children or the future or the planet or anything else. Well, my career has been involved with chairing committees on hazardous waste and soil conservation and so on. And by the way, that argument of caring about the planet was trumped by India, because India said, okay, we know the science. We've looked at the science. We know what's wrong with it. And yes, even if you're correct and 1 or 2 degrees of warming occurs over the next 100 years, That's manageable because you're telling us we've had a 1 degree warming in the last 100 years, but we've got greater priorities. We've got people starving to death. That's our priority right now. And so the question for the politician becomes one of priorities, which is almost eliminated by this bullying that the extremists have been doing. So what politicians in my experience have been tending to do is put on the cloak of green, appear to be, say, yeah, well, we care about all these things, but actually underneath doing some of the practical and sensible things to keep moving ahead. But the bigger problem, of course, with this is that if you put environment at the top of the issue, then it's almost always at the expense of something else. So, for example, in Canada, Environment Canada spent $6.8 billion, which is not a lot in American terms, but for one government department in Canada is huge. They spent that in 7 years. That's the Auditor General's figure. In that same period of time, they didn't even meet their own targets for air pollution reduction. And so it's this kind of priorizing and you mentioned the emotionalism that's being exploited. And it's very difficult to stand up to it. I've gone through that. But I concur with your comments exactly, and I understand where you're coming from.
Well,
if I could jump in here.
Please.
There is a tremendous amount of propaganda put out here. I'm looking at a Mother Jones magazine here, and I've always considered myself an environmentalist and a leftist, for that matter. But there's a small girl on the front cover, and she's saying with a little bubble, "I ate my broccoli. How about you fix the climate?" And then at the top, there's a story, Climate Countdown, a special report. Well, Mother Jones takes the attitude that, you know, that man-caused global warming is the most serious catastrophic event or issue facing humans, which is what our politicians, many of them, tell us. No wonder the public is confused. And yet, it seems to me that the public has enough common sense not to be corralled into this senseless fear. In fact, a March 2009 Gallup poll said global warming is clearly the environmental issue of least concern to Americans. In fact, global warming is the only issue for which more Americans say they have little to no concern than say they have a great deal of concern. So despite this tremendous propaganda onslaught, I think, you know, people see, hey, this has been a cold winter, and gee, last winter was really a cold winter, most people might even have an intuitive notion that warming is actually better for us in many ways, at least for many parts of the world, than cooling, and that is, in fact, the case. During the Little Ice Age, between 1500 and 1800, thereabouts, there was famine and starvation and short growing seasons all over Europe. And during the medieval warming period, when climate was warmer than today, between about 1000 A.D. and 1350 A.D., something like that, they were growing crops in Greenland, and the climate was 1 or 2 degrees warmer than today. So I think most people have a common sense understanding that, you know, just like day and night and winter and summer, climates change naturally. And this is the case, and somebody like Tim and myself, we study the magnitude and the frequency of natural climate change over the history of the Earth, and we start to understand the magnitude and the timing of natural climate changes. And we look at what's happened since the 1950, when we really started burning a lot of fossil fuels, and we see this amount of warming of less than about a half a degree centigrade is nothing compared to the natural climate changes that we can document from the geological record. And so in my own work, for instance, in Glacier Park, I show that the mean annual temperature, say within the last million years, has fluctuated by at least 16 to 18 degrees centigrade because you had paraglacial features that now form in northern Alaska in on the border with Canada and the United States during the cold periods. And you had warm-type, temperate, subtropical-type soils forming in the interglacials within the last million years. So the one requires temperatures were much colder, and the other requires that temperatures were much warmer. And we can go around the world and see that plants and animals have migrated a tremendous extent due to natural climate change. And as Tim says, CO2 is very, very, very small component of the climate system. But what we've had then is we've had a kind of a political takeover of an issue, and it's an issue that I dearly love. I've always considered myself an environmentalist and a climber and an outdoorsman, and so you know, I want to save the earth. But in fact, the debate is so skewed and so bogus and so full of lies and corruption that you need to look deeper and say, why are these people wanting these changes? What's the agenda behind it? And you see that Maurice Strong himself was one of the initiators of the Chicago Climate Exchange, which would profit mightily from cap-and-trade schemes. And you see that Al Gore is also involved in some of these major companies. All these guys, most of these real top guys, are very, very rich. Maurice Strong is a billionaire. And we see that the head of the IPCC has got many conflicts of interest. And although they call him a scientist, he's actually an economist from India who knows virtually nothing about climate science. And I'll just add one more thing before I give it up here. In terms of the corruption, it has, in the context of this recent leaking of the emails, which we call ClimateGate, it's also been revealed that a guy named William Connolly, who is one of about 8 or 9, shall we say, climate alarmists who are involved with the realclimate.org website, which puts out their position, and finds all kinds of reasons to believe that humans are causing, catastrophic climate change. He was, in fact, the gatekeeper of Wikipedia, and he himself altered or refused about 5,000 articles to the extent that they said anything about the medieval warm period, which I just mentioned. Now, the medieval warm period between about 1000 AD and 1350 was obviously caused by natural changes. It was obviously warmer than anything we've seen in the 20th century. And so that particular natural event didn't sit with the logic of anthropogenic man-caused global warming. So what do? They just edit it out. It's like 1984. You rewrite the past to fit the present policy. And so we've seen I understand it's very confusing because of the daily barrage of propaganda, but if people look deeper, they will see that this indeed is propaganda.
I know it's the mayor's turn, but just one quick comment to that, Eric. If you think about it, the corruption of the ClimateGate, as it's now called, the emails that were leaked, none of that would have been necessary if the fundamental science was valid. But the science wasn't valid, so they had to keep control of what was going on, and that's the corruption that we're seeing. Mr. Mayor, it's your turn.
Well, thanks. It's far more interesting for me to listen to you gentlemen than to listen to myself, since I can talk to myself at any time. But the thing that I find fascinating is what we're talking about in my mind is how do we make decisions based upon incomplete data? And that is the nature of science, and it is also the nature of us humans when we look at data. All we have to do is realize at one point we were convinced the world was flat. My background, while not scholastically even in comparison to both of you gentlemen, was a paramedic, and I was also an avalanche forecaster and studied snow quite a bit. And I can tell you when we first became paramedics, we were doing things that made sense scientifically, but unfortunately assured people's demise. Now, they were drugs we were using on dead people anyway, so it really didn't change much, but the science was not consistent with how the body actually worked. I think one of the things, whether it's medicine, whether it's climate change, one of the difficulties, and this goes back to something I said earlier, is for all of us to be honest in not stating just what we know, but spending more time on describing what we don't know. And I think we've all had personal experience with this. If we've been injured or ill, we end up with very definite diagnoses, but very rarely does the doc say, well, you know, we really don't know a lot about this, but this is our best guess. I'm also quite aware, in my mind, there's geologic time and then there's weather time. It reminds me of this butterfly sitting on a redwood in California, and another butterfly flies down. These butterflies have about 2 weeks of life, and says, is this thing alive? He goes, no, this tree's not alive. I've been here my whole life, and it's never changed a bit. And that's really the truth, both geologic and weather time. And yet there's no doubt in my mind that the Earth is going to outlast us. There's no species that's been perpetual in any of the geologic records. And I also question, again, how we make quality decisions while recognizing that the data will never be complete, and honestly recognizing the degree of politics involved in science as well. You can take the politicians out of the room and there's still plenty of politics going on in a scientific seminar. So it does leave us in a tough position. Just for clarity, in my position as a mayor of a small town, what we are forced to do at this point in time, just as a reminder, in the past year or two, we were reminded the free market isn't that free, at least when it comes to the financial industry. We're reacting in a pretty short term, with a pretty short term view. And what you guys are talking about is definitely not short term. And unfortunately, when we try to seek solutions to something that is a long term problem, and it creates inconvenience amongst the citizens, it becomes saleable by the media, in my opinion, and that increases the volume and reduces the facts. It's a conundrum. I wish I could help you guys in figuring out how to make it more balanced. What would be perfect in this little radio show would be to have someone who does believe the Earth is warming at a rapid rate caused by humans, and to be able to hear a point and counterpoint, and then to have a referee like the guy at the net in tennis who is describing what's actually being said in an impartial way. I can hear what you guys are saying, and the media is picking this up because fear sells. That's what sells the Wheaties, you know, on the commercials in between what they're saying. And it becomes, as I say, very difficult to understand. We have to boil it down to something that's highly simplistic and therefore not very realistic in terms of actions. When you're talking about politicians who are making the policy and getting twisted around by this stuff, I think you're looking at guys and gals at a higher level where it costs so much to run that, you know, like I think they said Lieberman, while he was senator, has accepted over $1 million from the insurance industry. To expect him to make an impartial decision regarding healthcare reform is, of course, absurd. And then, needless to say, oil, gas, blah, 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 those industries in the United States, they bankroll these guys. That's not the case locally. However, we have to fight upstream against a strong current that's created by the more centralized governments that have a lot more money and power. It becomes really an interesting exercise in how we can just kick our rudder a few degrees to make a significant change locally. And at some point, we'll talk about what we're trying to do. And it's not really a focus on climate change, but rather more on local control. So when Enron decides to make profit on what I call paper energy, as they did and cause California that serious problem, how can we insulate ourselves by using what we have here to energize our economy, and I mean actually through energy creation for ourselves rather than relying upon, you know, energy that's being created in the four corners using coal.
You're absolutely right. I absolutely agree with that. You know, in terms of fixing the climate, I don't think humans can or should try, because this is, like you say, we're butterflies on a sequoia. And the sequoia is a bigger system than yet we understand, or certainly than yet we can control. Or should, for that matter, unless there's some evil intent, because the Earth is so big that if one area modifies it to their benefit, it hurts the next person. So this climate should not be on the table of action items, in my opinion. I think that it's fairly easy to prove that the people that are pushing this agenda very hard have a geopolitical agenda. And Tim Ball talked about the Club of Rome think tank, which is very powerful, issuing these statements in the 70s, 1973 and 4. No less a politician than George Kennan, who actually set up the rules for the whole Cold War engagement with the Soviet Union, wrote a paper in Foreign Affairs, which is the journal for the Council on Foreign Relations, called To Prevent a World Wasteland, a Proposal. And he said, not even the most casual reader of the public prints of recent months and years could be unaware of the growing chorus of warnings from qualified scientists as to what industrial man is now doing by overpopulation, plundering of the Earth's resources, and by a precipitate mechanism of many of life's processes to the intactness of the natural environment on which his survival depends. So this is the idea that we all have a common enemy, which is, I guess, ourselves now. So we need to control ourselves more. We need to depopulate. We need to deindustrialize certain areas, and we need to certainly control that process. So these are our top policy planners. With a long-term agenda, which, and if you start to look at the history of this thing, as Tim has, you can see this agenda being played out in all over the place. And you can also see, as I said, how the main players, like the head of the IPCC and Maurice Strong and Al Gore, are profiteering mightily from this process. So the science doesn't hold up if one looks at it. The politics is crooked as it gets. And the propaganda is fierce. So I think this is a non-issue, except that it helps us to focus on and see who are the people that are trying to direct the course of history, and what are they up to, and how do they operate? And I see this as a mechanism to understand them. Now, I've got a website called naturalclimatechange.us, in which I'm putting up various articles and PowerPoint presentations. And even interviews like this to help educate people. And I think if you look around on websites around the world and on the Internet, you'll see that people all around the world are smart, they're looking at this issue. They don't necessarily have to have a degree in the right field to observe what the weather does or to understand climate change over periods of hundreds of years or whatever. You're seeing a lot of people weigh in because people are understanding that the implications of these policy changes would be enormous. And for that reason, Dr. Tim Ball, who is one of the courageous advocates early on, has actually had a death threat pointed his way. So there's a very strong agenda of the corporatocracy, of certainly the British government. The BBC every day has some headlines about how the ice is melting or the polar bears are dying or it's going to be worse than we thought. I mean, every day. And this is not backed up by science. This is all based on computer models, which, of course, garbage in, garbage out.
You know, it's a fascinating study. The first I heard of true climate change, and I believe this was out of the UN, and I wish I could tell you specifically, but someone, alpine downhill racing has been happening in Europe since the 30s, and they charted whether they could finish the races at the traditional finish. And they have, the finishes have been moving up over years since the 30s. And yet we're only talking about a 70 or 80 year range. So I have to agree with you on that. Gentlemen, one thing I'm hearing is the idea that there's a grand conspiracy, and perhaps there is. Melody and I have had these discussions before. From my perspective, I don't think you need a grand conspiracy. I'm watching folks in our lovely town here in the Intermountain, Colorado. Now that gas is cheap and the automobile industry in this country is reeling, buying SUVs and pickups. You know, they have a very short memory. And I think we all know whether it's actually a limited resource, regardless of one's view or manipulation of the market, that gas is going to $4 a gallon here within the next 18 months. I don't see how it can't. And yet the gas guzzlers are cheap, so let's buy them. And so I think a lot of what you're talking about, the classic is there's now a lot of media in our local area about, as a matter of fact, I just was skiing in Aspen, Colorado, which is not known as a very poor area of the United States. And there was angry articles from coal miners saying if we reduce our use of coal, and this was mostly regarding cap and trade, we're going to lose our jobs. And so these local issues, I think, are really the flywheel that will keep any significant changes from occurring. And perhaps it is to all of our benefit that the more strident people who disagree with you two gentlemen keep their screaming going just to move us a little bit more towards center. I think in our species, and this is a pretty cynical opinion, and I'll probably hear about this, I think what we consider a major problem is really a minor inconvenience and is largely overstated, especially if policies are instituted over a long time. But what my point is I'm not so worried about the conspiracy guys as much as the folks down here on the ground who want things to stay the same. They want their 2.5 televisions per house. They want cheap gas regardless of the market, regardless of our guys and gals getting killed in the Mideast and other places. It's this inability for us to be inconvenienced personally for what might be good for the whole, and that bothers me, whether it's finance, whether it's healthcare, whether it's climate, potential climate change, and that discussion, limited resources. I think we need the push and pull to maintain that balance.
But I think, Mr. Mayor, I've been accused of being a conspiracy theorist. There are conspiracies, there's no question. I mean, certainly the group that planned to blow up the British Parliament in 1609, by the way, they're reputed to be the only people that ever went to Parliament with good intentions. But I prefer to call this a cabal. C-A-B-A-L, which is another English term. It's made up of the initials of very powerful people in the British society. And it's a group of like-minded people that want to impose their particular view of how a society should be run and the way it should go. One of the difficulties, your comment about having those extremists out there, I would agree with you, but I would disagree with you in the sense that it implies then that we're extremists at the other end of the spectrum. In fact, what has happened here, as I mentioned, is the stifling of the debate. And in fact, when I give presentations to audiences now, I'll quite often start out by saying, look, I'm going to give you a biased presentation because all you've heard up to now is a bias. I will give you the other bias and then you can draw your own conclusions at the end. And I see myself as much more towards the center, and certainly I would judge that from Eric's comments, and yet we are promoted as extremists. And as I mentioned, that letter that we sent to the British or the Canadian Prime Minister, all that we asked for was a debate with all the facts on the table. But the control, for example, of the IPCC, they were very, very selective in who got to serve on that. They didn't allow the dissenting voices, which would have been much healthier. And now the John Beddington, the science advisor in Britain, is agreeing to that. And so this is the difficulty I have, that there's been this imbalance, and all I want is a balance. The other two points I want to make is that your comment about priorizing, one of the arguments that's been used by the extreme environmentalists is what is called the precautionary principle. And this is the argument that, well, shouldn't we act anyway or just in case? And the difficulty with that argument, I made the point when I appeared before the Canadian Parliament, Parliamentary Committee on the ozone issue, and I realized that the politicians didn't understand the scientific method, how science works, and they were focusing on the ozone issue specifically, but I set my presentation aside and gave a completely different presentation in which I got up and I said, look, I'm going to give you some scientific facts out of which I'm going to show you that there's a real problem. And the facts were that the Earth's slowing down in its speed of rotation, and that's been going on for 1,000 years. The Earth's magnetic field has been weakening for 1,000 years. And if it continues to weaken at the current rate, then in about 120 years from now, there will be no magnetic field. And we know from the geologic record when the magnetic field disappears in these reversal events that there's massive extinction of species. And I want to know what my government's planning to do about this. Well, of course, they were absolutely outraged. But my point was, look, I could stand there, and I said this to them, I can stand here all day, all week, all month as a scientist and take a few facts and create all kinds of threatening issues and so on. And the challenge then, especially when it comes to these scientific issues, is how do you set the political priorities that are absolutely essential because you've got limited budgets and limited abilities to deal with things. And so that is at the basis of I think of the comments, Mr. Mayor. The other issue that has come up here is the funding. I know on the web you can find Tim Ball's paid by the oil companies. The fact is I've never received a nickel. I joke about saying I wish I had, and I might be able to afford their product. I've never received a nickel from any energy company or any oil company. My research funding came from the National Museum of Canada because they fully understand the problem of humans living in a physical world. And I now live on a pension and money I make from public speaking. So I've never received any monies. But, of course, the accusation that you're in the pay of some group is immediately a very effective smear. And what's interesting to me about this is, I'm not supporting Exxon, but Exxon admitted to $16 million in funding. As far as I know, none of that ever went to primary climate research. All it went to was research on what are the scientists saying about the climate. Now, if I was an investor buying in Exxon and they weren't doing their research on, well, what's the climate doing and where it's going to go? I mean, who's affected more possibly than the agriculture, but who's affected more than the energy companies? I wouldn't invest in a company that wasn't doing that kind of research. They've stopped doing it now, and if I was a shareholder, I'd be screaming about that. But on the other side of the equation is that in 1 year, the U.S. government spent $70 billion on climate research. And all of that was directed to proving that CO2 and humans were the problem. There's virtually no funding going to disprove the theory. And, of course, science works by disproving a theory or a hypothesis, not proving it. And I watched this happen. In fact, about 20 years ago, I jokingly said, you know, when I fill out an application for funding and virtually all of it coming from government, you've got to put in the right catchwords, the right keywords, like in a Google search. And I joked about how I was desperately looking for a connection between climate and AIDS, and the money would pour forth from the government. And so this has so distorted the research far more than any funding from government or from private industry, although I'm not denying that that exists. For example, during the ozone issue, a major pusher of ozone, the problem, were the companies selling sunblockers. I mean, who benefited more? A major pusher of global warming and climate change have been Zurich, Swiss Re, the major insurance companies. You go and look at the Swiss Re website, and it's just absolutely full of this stuff. So businesses have exploited this as well. But as I say, when you look at the amount of money and the control of climate research, virtually all of it has been from government agencies. So these are parts of the distortion that make the problem even more complicated than it should be.
Well, don't we wish that
incredible scientists such as Dr. Ball have been deliberately sidelined and marginalized and vilified, and as I said, there have been death threats. So we have seen a campaign, and I'm old enough to have seen it develop over time. This idea of man-caused global warming, picking up speed in the 80s, and then in the 90s, and then this decade, supposed to be the greatest threat to facing mankind, et cetera. This is really when you start to look at there's books about this. You can follow all this stuff, and you can educate yourself about this. I know it takes a lot of time, but even as we try to some scientists try to bring some reality to bear, many of our top politicians don't understand the very, very basics. As Dr. Ball says, here's a quote from Representative Henry Waxman, a Democrat from California, who's chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Here's what he says: "We're seeing the reality a lot of the North Pole starting to evaporate, and we could get to a tipping point because if it evaporates to a certain point, they have lanes now where ships can go that couldn't ever sail through before. And if it gets to a point where it evaporates too much, there's a lot of tundra that's being held down by that ice cap." And we've had Al Gore, our former environmental vice president, say that, for the last 3 million years, the ice caps are melting. These guys don't seem to understand that in the South Pole you have a huge continent called Antarctica with a huge amount of ice, like 90% of the world's fresh water is in that ice, and those are continental-sized glaciers. Over the North Pole, we have ocean, open ocean. And in the wintertime, you have a layer of sea ice or pack ice, which is maybe 8 or 10 feet thick. And so when Henry Waxman, when they say the ice caps are melting, they don't seem to understand the basic geography of the Earth. So we're dealing with such scientific illiteracy on the part of our politicians. And as we've discussed earlier, Maurice Strong, the guy who orchestrated this push, himself only has a grade 9 education from Canada. So, and some of the climatologists call this whole thing the revenge of the sea students, the revenge of the people who really don't know any science. So this is what makes it so difficult to operate when you have a media and a political environment in which there is a promotion of ideas which fit a political agenda. It doesn't matter whether those ideas are scientifically valid or not. Yes, there is a lot of uncertainty in the climate field. Yes, it's a young field. No, we don't know everything. But anybody who knows something about paleoclimate can tell you that the amount of climate change we've seen in the last 100 years is minuscule compared to the amount of climate change that the Earth has undergone under natural conditions. And that in nature, for most of the Earth's history, the climate was considerably warmer than today, and there was more CO2, and plants thrived, and animals got big, and we had dinosaurs, and we had gigantism in the mammals in the Cenozoic. So it does look like science fraud. It smells like science fraud. It's propaganda, I think that Dr. Ball has said that, it could be that once the public catches on to this, this is going to be a tremendous black eye for scientists in general, and that's a sad thing. But before we go too much further down those roads, I wanted to ask Dr. Ball, maybe this would bear on the question too. To some extent, the tremendous threat of acid rain and ozone hole were also promoted by the press. Would you say that in similar manner that these environmental threats were, to a large extent, over-exaggerated and contrived, Tim? Another example of the same kind of dynamic?
Yeah. Well, I was also involved in a commission of inquiry into the acid rain issue in eastern Canada, and there was a big debate going on. Mulroney was the prime minister at the time, and he was yelling about how the U.S. coal industry was producing acid rain that was destroying maple trees and the maple industry in Quebec and so on. Yes, there were some very point source evidences of acid rain, but just to illustrate the idea, very few people know that all rain is acid rain. As the raindrops form, they absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, and therefore are about a 10% carbonic acid solution naturally. The acid rain that became the focus was, of course, that sulfur from particularly smelters and coal-burning plants was mixing into the rain and creating a mild form of sulfuric acid. And there is no question, because I lived in Sudbury, which was the one of the single largest point sources of sulfur into the atmosphere, that it killed the trees within a mile or two of the smelter. Now, of course, once they realized what was going on, they put the filters on, and that stopped it. But here's the irony of it. Further downwind, the trees were benefiting from that sulfur because it was a form of fertilizer. And now that they've stopped it, a lot of the trees are suffering. Yes, it was a localized problem, but it was exaggerated and finger pointing, and of course it's always industry and humans, and I'm not here to whitewash industry. There's certainly a lot of pollution that needs to be dealt with, but it certainly was exploited for that purpose. And you notice that the problem has virtually gone away. And by the way, with regard to the maple industry in Quebec, it turned out that the decrease in maple syrup yields, was not due to acid rain at all. It was due to two factors. One was that there were droughts. Drier conditions created less sap and therefore less maple syrup. And also they had a sequence of quite early spring, very mild early, the trees started to grow, and then very hard frosts hit, which, of course, causes what they call dieback. Now, the tree will still continue to produce leaves, but much, much reduced, and therefore the amount of sap was reduced. So those were the explanations, and not the acid rain. With regard to the ozone issue, The ironic thing about it is that, and by the way, it parallels the global warming and CO2 issue very, very nicely, because it was determined that, the measurement of the so-called ozone hole over Antarctica, and there never was a hole, there was an area of thinning, but even at its thinnest, the ozone layer was still one-third of the average for the world. And somebody came out and said, that's being created by CFCs. Now, that evidence came from a lab in California where they put CFCs into a container with ozone, and it destroyed the ozone. You could do this kind of experiment with a whole bunch of things in a laboratory setting. But that doesn't recreate the minus 90 conditions over Antarctica and the circulations and the lack of sunlight and all the rest of it. But immediately there was a jump to, it's the CFCs that are causing the thinning of the ozone. What they ignored completely, and again, when I appeared before that ozone committee and I was asked a question about it, ozone is created by ultraviolet radiation. It's caused when ultraviolet hits oxygen in the atmosphere, it splits the O2 of oxygen into single oxygen molecules, which then very quickly combine into three oxygens of molecules, which is then O3, which is ozone. And what they assumed was that the ultraviolet radiation was constant. Well, this is the same thing they've done with the climate issue. They've assumed that the sun is not the cause of the change. It's essentially constant. And that's so silly that you don't even know where to start talking about it. And we now know that ultraviolet varies by as much as 200% naturally. And not only that, but CFCs in their commercial form are four times more dense than air. And I don't know of any mechanism in the atmosphere that would carry them to the minimum of 15 kilometers above the surface of the Earth that is necessary for them to start affecting the ozone. And it's very interesting that one of the scientists that was claiming that there was evidence of CFCs above the Antarctic was a Susan Solomon, who is also a co-chair of the science report in the IPCC. And so you see these connections of these people. All of these issues, taking simple little things and exploiting them and exploiting people's fears and blaming the big bad industry.
What I find interesting about the ozone case is that this was, I think, almost a dry run for the CO2. In the sense that nations of the world came together and signed the Montreal Protocol, which caused a phase out of CFCs, which meant that certain businesses did well and other businesses did poorly. So Margaret Thatcher's there, making these proclamations about how we had a global problem and we solved it as a world and we got the nations of the world in this treaty. And this was supposed to be, I think, in some ways, the template or the precursor of these Kyoto-type...
Of the Kyoto Accord. Jerry, just to expand on that a bit, the Montreal Protocol, much like the Kyoto Accord, most of the countries of the world became part of it, but only a few of them were required to reduce their CFC production. So in exactly the same way as the CO2, so countries like China and India were not required to reduce. And not only that, but when they were asked to appear at the Montreal Protocol, they said, look, why don't you reduce your CFC levels, because you're telling us it's a problem and you're the ones that created it, and let us bring ours up to an equal level. We said no. They immediately said, we're not signing the Montreal Protocol. We're not participating in this. Because one of the critical things about the CFCs was they were produced as a non-toxic, neutral, no harm on the environment chemical to increase refrigeration capacity. And when we start talking about world food supply, it was the refrigeration ability that reduced food loss by about 30% on a global basis, which led to reduction of famine and starvation and so on. So here we were again saying to the developing world and the famine-stricken world, no, you can't do that. We're not allowing that. Paul Dreesen's written about this in eco-imperialism, this imposition of our eco ideas to essentially keep these countries in slavery. So the Montreal Protocol and that whole thing. And of course, they're saying, oh, now look at the ozone's recovering and so on. Well, if there never was a problem in the first place, and you'd say we took a solution, then it looks like your solution worked. You really can't go wrong. And by the way, that idea, Eric, is what they're saying, well, here's a natural event. Then they're telling you it's unnatural, which means that tomorrow there's going to be more natural events, therefore they can never be wrong, and that's the game they're playing with the climate issue.
Well, not only that, but the whole acid rain issue, sulfur dioxide and whatnot, this became the impetus for the idea of pollution credits, which was instituted, I think, under the first Bush administration, the idea that the government would set levels of pollution and then companies could reach that level, and if they exceeded it, they could pay extra penalty to another company that didn't reach their quota of pollution. So this then put the gas, the sulfur oxides, as a trading commodity on the market. And so now all of a sudden, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, all these things then become something that people in Wall Street can trade on and get rich on.
Gentlemen, that one of the reasons why I called the program Truth Quest is that sometimes when you're looking at some avenues that seem may be totally unrelated, end up having a connection in ways that you're not even necessarily looking for when you're trying to find the truth. And what it seems to me that you're revealing was kind of brought out a little bit in the statement you said earlier about the contributing to the enslavement of some of these third world countries. Well, when you start going back and look at the writings of some of these men that are perpetrating this global warming issue, is you find that it isn't necessarily about the climate at all. It has more to do with control of the and social engineering.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and certainly when you look at I think Richard Lindzen at MIT says that whoever controls carbon controls the world, and of course this was the objective of the Club of Rome, was one world government. And of course Obama talked about that when he was in Copenhagen, and in a meeting prior to Copenhagen he said this is the best chance for one world government, and that became the vehicle. Another little side, and by the way, the word for what you just described, Melody, is serendipity in science. We talk about serendipity. That is, you're doing research on one thing and you just happen to stumble across something else. And there are many examples of this. Penicillin was one example of this kind of situation. But one of the things I'd like to comment for the mayor's
benefit.
Work on.
Okay.
Yeah. It is that we've used, since the Second World War, and of course we had income tax came in to pay for the war, and it was just a temporary measure, and we know how long that lasted. But we've used taxes for social engineering, and it really started in Britain with the healthcare system there and the public schooling and all the rest of it, and the Clement Attlee government after the war. But the taxes have been used much really in punitive ways. That is to punish you for doing behaving in a certain way. I would like to suggest that taxes could be far more beneficial if they were used for positive incentives to do things. Now, one of the things that I have experienced is nobody likes paying taxes, but people understand, yeah, we've got to pay the bill. Somebody's got to have some money to make the things function a little bit. But if somebody finds a way around a tax, there's a general sympathy for that. They say, well, you know, it's not fair. They should pay their fair share. It shouldn't happen. But there's a sort of grudging, you know, I wish I could get away with it. But if you had a positive reward, a positive tax for doing something, then the punishment for not doing it would have much more meaning. As it is now, by making the tax negative, then punishing people for not doing it has virtually no real effect. But if you, as I said, if you had positive things and provide in a sense, I mean, a very good example is the getting a refund on returning a soft drink can. I mean, it's created a whole industry of people out there picking them out of the garbage and almost making a living out of it. And that's just a positive re-incentive and incentive. And I'd like to see far more of that rather than this punitive approach that we're, you know, you're misbehaving. And of course, it's part of the whole thing of environmentalism as the religion, and it's essentially become the new Puritanism.
I've often wondered if that back in the 70s when we went through this so-called energy crisis and the sort, when people started getting creative and coming up with these alternative methods, and then all of a sudden we had this abrupt cutback, I had a feeling that most of that came about because there was so much innovation and ways to get around the petroleum industry, which to me, again, the petroleum industry has never been honest in saying that they make far much more money off of the byproducts of the petroleum than it is off the vehicles. Yeah. And this, again, comes back to the issue is they have us arguing about things that are not what's really taking place. And this is why I am a conspiracy theorist, because if you're not a conspiracy theorist, then you are a oh my goodness, I thought the term of what I want now.
Coincidence.
But coincidence theorist. So
yeah.
we need to be able to stand back and look at the real issues taking place and who's involved and start looking at their background and what do they have to gain from it. And so often we just react to the very first layer of what's going on.
I think that in regard to your comment, the old saying that necessity is the mother of invention, it certainly holds true. And you know, when things get tough, people start looking at innovative ways of dealing with it and coping with it. And I don't think any nation in the world has done that better than the U.S. That idea. But on the other side of it, I think in Canada, I'm writing a book right now about Canada, and the title of it is The Complacency of Superabundance. And I think that it can also be applied to the U.S. And I think it goes to some of the comments that the mayor was making earlier, that people of what they've come to expect as normal and standard because of this complacency of superabundance. And then suddenly when there's a downturn, it just throws the whole thing into chaos. And, you know, one of the great ironies is, and it's a terrible tragedy in Haiti, but for the Haiti people that are already at subsistence, they're better able to cope with it than we are. Because think about in our society, when the power goes off, we're absolutely lost. And so I think that those are some of the other things that we need to be are being drawn to our attention because of these sudden shortages and sudden problems that we've been very complacent.
Gentlemen, one of the things that comes to mind listening to everyone speak today is whether I think we can make the assumption that the issues are more complex, but even if they're not, the quantity of data is so extreme and it's so available now, it takes a conscious effort to slice and dice them. One of the things that I think anyone who's honest in the United States has to admit, of the first world countries, our educational system is falling into disrepair. And listening to you, gentlemen, and Melody, I really believe that it reinforces my desire to increase the quality of education. And yes, it will mean to sacrifice a little bit. This goes back to taxes. What is the incentive? Well, the incentive is to create something for someone other than myself in the future by increasing the quality of education. So we have people who can analyze all this data as citizens, not necessarily scientists, and come up with reasonable solutions for the greater good. The other thing I find, and I bet both of you would tell me this never existed, but it surely was couched in terms that science for a long time operated in an ivory tower. I find that very difficult to believe when I read the history of the Enlightenment and even during Einstein's period. You know, there was plenty of backbiting and knifing going on, but the idea that so much of science is directly associated, just so you gentlemen can fund your work, with such a degree of money now that just by virtue of that fact, we have gone from skeptics as a public watching this stuff to cynics. Once you're cynical, it's very hard to move anyone from a position. We tend to listen to those who believe what we believe in and as a result harden our positions rather than be open to possible views that are different than our own. So I'm using this moment to really push the idea that we need to continue to push for quality education. And if it's at all reasonable, try to create an environment for scientists to do truly independent research, not funded necessarily by those who have the greatest chance of making great benefit from it.
I want to jump in there, though. This again comes back into that thing of connecting the different dots from different aspects, and this the same group of people controlling not only the science and the military-industrial complex and our energy and our various aspects of our lives, and then the educational system has been stifled, as of several interviews that Eric and I have tried to just cover on what's taking place in the California universities. But that in my interviews with Charlotte Iserbay and John Taylor Gatto, is the fact that they've purposely tried to degrade our education system, that there was an ulterior motive behind that. And to do that is to starve it through funding.
Well, I think that's true, Melody. However, I think it depends on which side of the digestive system one wants to look at. And what I do believe is we live in a school district where probably 95% of the bond issues are not passed based solely upon the fact that people don't want to increase their property taxes. That's it. That's it. And so sometimes Melody and I've had these discussions off the air, gentlemen, and as you can well tell, I don't believe you have to have a conspiracy, because it doesn't take much to push us in the direction, as long as we're seeking comfort and for ourselves rather than what's for the greater good. But I do, I believe if we demand, there was not a great scientist, P.J. O'Rourke, in his book Parliament of Fools, the last line is, we get the legislators we deserve. Now, of course, I'm an exception to that, but you're all supposed to laugh when I say that. But I think that's the case. I think that's the case. We get the education we deserve. We get the politicians we deserve. The amount of time that is spent in this country anyway, in the United States, that each citizen spends, paying attention to what's going on in their lives that's being driven by the politics is really minimal.
You have to remember that there was a period back when we were younger that they were throwing money at education in all kinds of ways. And it was also during this period that they were also, there was a concerted effort to bring down or dumb down the populace for what the think tanks had sat back and looked at and realized that they were not going to be having the jobs of the future in these technical areas. They were going to be more in the service industry or into these third world type situations.
Listen, I think this is a great argument, but right now we have Dr. Tim Ball with us. Let's just go back to him a little bit, and I'll just say also in terms of what you said, Chuck, the money that I've gotten to do research over my career as a physical geographer has been mostly out of my own pocket, with some small university grants of maybe $3,000, $4,000 here and there, which I would use for radiocarbon dates so that I could figure out how old the sediments are that I'm interpreting. So I am not one of the big money scientists out there, and yet I've had a career. I'm now teaching at a California State University, which is a teaching-oriented university. Dr. Ball has operated on a more research-intensive level, and he's now retired. And he's writing articles virtually every week, I think, in which he's trying to educate the public. And what we have here is a guy who is motivated to educate. He's there to give talks to schools of all different ages. And so I think we should hear from Tim on that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, Eric. But I do agree with the mayor about education. I mean, it's fundamental. And by the way, I have worked with homeschool people, try to help them with their programs. And I think one of the measures of what's wrong with the public education is that in Canada, anyway, students that are in homeschooling perform anywhere up to four grades ahead of students that are in the public school system. And I think that's very telling about the education system. The other reason I've been involved in education, I'm the only professor in the province of Manitoba, anyway, who was chair of a teachers group. I was very proud of that, and it was because I realized that the students that I was getting had come out of that K-12 system, and if I didn't know where they were coming from and what they knew. And what triggered me to that was when I did a survey amongst my colleagues, they didn't even know the textbooks that were being used in the school system from which their students were coming. So This has been very much at the heart of my concerns and issues. And also, of course, I also believe that if you're going to criticize things, you enhance your credibility if you're willing to try and improve on it. But the whole idea of education and shifting it with the internet, the availability of data and information, one of the things that's concerned me is that the school system has become more about indoctrination rather than education. And I joked about one of Maggie Thatcher's problems was that she knew that she wanted the educated populace, but she also knew that the minute they were educated, they start asking questions, and you can't allow that. So one of the problems with the internet is that we're not teaching our students how to discriminate in terms of sources of information, credibility of information. And so this is one of the reasons, of course, that William Connolly, that Eric mentioned earlier with regard to controlling the climate data. I was speaking at a school in northern Alberta recently, and I asked them, how many of you use Wikipedia? Well, every single hand in the room went up. And, of course, what Connolly did was he not only controlled all of the climate-related stuff, but he also set it up so that if you if you typed in global warming, then it was the Wikipedia entry that came up first, and therefore that's what was being used. So I think these things are very, very much integrated. And the other problem I have is, again, I know a little bit about the U.S. system. I know more about the British and the Canadian system, obviously. But much of the propaganda has occurred in the school system because climate and global warming have been taught and relegated to the social sciences in the curriculum. And I know in a lot of the schools I talk to, the science teachers are very frustrated. They said, we should be teaching it. Now, the reality is, of course, that the climate and the climate science should be taught in the science curriculum. And then once the students understand the science, then you can have a reasonable debate about the social implications of it. But as it is, what you end up with is debates in these social studies classes that are really simply propaganda. And unfortunately, certainly in Canada and Britain, social science teachers tend to be left in their political spectrum. So there's a bias within the classroom as well. So I see all of these things as integrated into part of the problem that we're talking about. But I would vote for the mayor every time if he was going to push the education issue. But I know what he's saying, because everybody says, oh, yeah, we want this. And they say, well, okay, you're going to have to pay for it. Oh, well, I don't want to pay for it. It's sort of like the joke about the Canadian military when I was in there. Said, "War? I didn't join to fight. Let me out." And so you get that that attitude that people say they want things, but when it comes to paying for it, they're not willing. And so you end up with this gradual degradation of the whole system.
Well, let me ask you this, Tim. Do you think that with the fact that Copenhagen pretty much stalled out as you perceive it? Do you think that this whole issue has lost its momentum, or do you think that you and I and others like us are still going to be trying to educate the public on this issue in another 5 years, or do you think that they are actually going to prevail and some of these major societal changes are going to get ramrodded through no matter what the evidence is?
I think that if you look at, you mentioned one of the polls, and there was the Pew Center poll that put global warming at the very bottom. It was a list of 21, and it was the 21st. That's been showing up in a lot of polls and elections recently. Climate and global warming at very, very low on the list. Polls in Britain showing that 80% of the public, at Times of London did a poll, 80% of Britons don't think that humans are causing global warming or climate change. So the public are using that common sense that you talked about, and it's something I've always relied on, is this huge well of common sense in the ordinary people. And a part of this for me was when I gave a talk to the public, the most common comment I got afterwards was, I had my suspicions, but I didn't know enough to know.
Yeah.
I think that the disconnect right now is that at what point are the political leaders going to realize that the public are not buying this anymore? And of course, one of the reasons that a lot of the politicians are not wanting to buy that is because, A, they built their career on being green and being, you know, this is a major issue for them. The second is, of course, the potential for carbon taxes and the control that provides. And of course, that was the whole objective of Kyoto carbon tax and cap and trade. And if you look at Obama, I mean, I think he estimated $625 billion in revenue over the course of his term of office from cap and trade. Well, you take that out, and I mean, his deficit is far worse than it is right now. So those things are going to keep driving it. The other difficulty we have, is of course the mainstream media. Have been absolutely shameful in this whole process. I mean, Andrew Revkin, who was writing articles about the Arctic ice melting and all of these things. In fact, he had a book for children that was so full of errors, it was unbelievable. And he was actually in email communication with these people at East Anglia, saying, well, you know, I'm hearing about this, what do I say about that? And also George Monbiot of the Guardian in England, the same situation. The BBC, in fact, one of the emails said, look, this guy in the BBC did this story. We better get him shut up. I'll contact my person at the BBC to close this down. And so the mainstream media, as I said, have been absolutely shameful in this. And it's at the lower levels. It's the talk radio. Of course, I know they'll say, well, that's Republican or right wing and so on. But that's where the issue is being discussed and talked about. And by the way, some of the really good stories and interviews I've had have been with very localized newspapers. And there's one here in Canada called Epoch Times, and they've been presenting the other side. But as I said at my opening comments about the mayor, the local media have to confront the citizens on the street. They're going to meet them in the supermarket. If I want to meet with John Stossel or Bill O'Reilly, I haven't got a hope. So it's really this divorce between the power and the people that is just a widening gap.
Dr. Ball and Dr. Carlstrom, isn't it true that James Hansen, one of the leading spokesmen on this issue, is also been given a position as to be called a czar?
Yeah, I've read that.
Yes, I've heard that as well. He wouldn't be any better than Holdren. He's as extreme with regard to the climate issues. Hansen is a very interesting case, of course, because he's the guy that appeared before Gore's committee in 1988 and made the completely unscientific statement that he was 99% certain that the warming was due to humans. He told Stephen Schneider off the record afterwards that he really shouldn't have made that statement, but he never went back to the committee and corrected it. And Hansen, of course, has used his position as the director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies to manipulate the data. For example, he got caught where he had adjusted historic record lower to make the increase in temperature look greater. And when Gore in his movie said that 9 of the 10 warmest years were in the 1990s, well, in the U.S. it turned out that 4 of the 10 warmest years were in the 1930s, and that 1998 wasn't the warmest year, it was 1934. And Hansen also has been acting, for example, he went to England and gave testimony at a trial of Greenpeace activists who had actually done damage to a coal plant, and he testified on their behalf. Now, he plays the game that when he appears before public or their committees or whatever, when it suits him, he's a private citizen. When it suits him, he's the director of NASA GIS. So it's a political game, but one could argue that in many of his activities, he's actually in violation of the Hatch Act, which was designed to put a limit upon the political activities of a bureaucrat. Hansen's activities and his behavior I say he couldn't be worse than Holdren, but he certainly wouldn't be any better.
I might also add that his training is as an astronomer, and Dr. Stephen Schneider, who's been another major figure in the global warming alarmism push, his training is as a biologist. And we often see that many of these people cross disciplines in their expertise, and they don't have the background that Dr. Ball has or that I have. In understanding the long-term dynamics of climate or the short-term.
Yeah, well, of course, Eric, that's the problem I talked about earlier about climate being a generalist discipline, and so that anybody can pop up and say, well, I'm a climatologist, but that's the double standard. It's the same thing when I appear on radio or TV. The immediate question is, well, what are your qualifications? I've never heard anybody ask Al Gore that. Never. So you see this double standard that goes on in all of these issues, we've got the guy that's been major in the computer models for the IPCC, Andrew Weaver, who's at the local university here. He's put himself out as a climatologist. In fact, he's a computer modeler. And he just happened to do a doctoral thesis on atmosphere and ocean interactions And then from that, he's morphed into this climatology expert. And I remember the very first interview I had with him, within 15 minutes, I knew he knew very little about climate. Yet here he is a major player in the climate models.
Well, gentlemen, the mayor, I believe, is going to need to be departing here shortly. But in the meantime, I would like to just briefly hit upon the weather control issues and the programs that are involved out there that should be tied in with this same issue.
Yeah, what Eric mentioned a couple of them earlier. They're in the general category of geoengineering. And these ideas have been around for a long time, and if you want to argue, you could say that the traditional rain dances were attempts to control the weather, and of course that's been at the forefront of human activity. Some of the earliest achievements of humans, fire, for example, was an attempt at local climate control. Clothing was another attempt at climate control, temperature control. And, of course, irrigation, which began 9,000 years ago in the Tigris and Euphrates area, is another example. So but those are passive, basically passive things. Geoengineering, as it's now discussed, is active interference with the weather. And back in the 70s, because of cooling, of course, there were all these proposals to warm the Earth up. And I remember proposals of putting giant mirrors up in space to direct sunlight into northern cities to increase warmth. The Russians had a proposal to build a dam across the Bering Straits to block cold water coming out of Antarctica, warm up the North Pacific, and then have a warming effect around the globe. There were many of these ideas. Now, of course, we're seeing the same thing. Some of the experiments have actually been carried out. For example, somebody decided that if they dropped iron filings onto the ocean, it would increase the capacity of the oceans to absorb CO2 and therefore reduce CO2 levels. Those experiments were carried out, and they were done over a two-year period. No consideration of what effect that was having on the phytoplankton or the chemistry of the upper ocean. And they now have discovered that it didn't work at all. There's also the arguments about the HAARP project, the High Altitude Atmospheric Research Project, that's going on out of Alaska, putting stuff into the stratosphere and so on. The danger of all of this is if you don't understand the mechanisms and you don't know what you're doing, you're potentially going to create far more problems. It is a classic case of where you're far better to do nothing. And I talked earlier about other weather modifications. I don't know if they're still in the court system, but there are now some lawsuits pursuing where, for example, farmers in South Dakota had a drought. They got permission to do cloud seeding. There was a cloud burst, a dam burst, and several people died, and there was lawsuits over that. And then there was the case of the state of Idaho had a drought. They got Washington had a drought. They had forest fires. They got permission to cloud seed and put out the forest fires. Idaho then had a drought, and they're blaming Washington for stealing their rain. So all of these things are really, in my opinion, madness. And one of the ways to think about that is if let's say that CO2 was the problem, one of the proposals you might have made back in the 70s to offset the cooling was to put more CO2 into the atmosphere. What effect would that have had downstream if CO2 was an issue? So in a way, it's almost arrogant to think that we can have any meaningful effect, particularly when you think that in one thunderstorm there's more energy than 25 hydrogen bombs.
And as far as the CO2 goes, doesn't like your earthquakes and your earth movements and that sort release far more than what, you know?
And volcanic activity, and not just from the volcanoes themselves, but CO2 is leaking out around volcanoes for hundreds of kilometers around the volcano in very high quantities, and that's been measured at Mount Etna and other places. So, and under the oceans, of course, CO2 leaking into the oceans from all of this activity, yes.
Okay, well, if you guys would like to give some closing comments here so the mayor can go ahead and get on with his busy day, then we can, and I really want to thank you gentlemen too while I'm at it, because this has been a very good enlightening and discussion, and I think that our audience will really enjoy it.
Well, I opened by saying that I really appreciated the mayor coming to this, and that's maybe the nicest compliment I could pay. That based on what he said today, I'd vote for him any time. And the fact that to keep an open mind is so important. It's the closed minds that are the problem, the single-mindedness of things that is causing our problems. And of course, as the mayor correctly said, that you open the minds through education, and that's the key to the whole thing. And I hope that we've answered some questions for the mayor today. And I'd like to leave an offer that if he ever has any questions about any of these climate issues, or particularly the water issue, which I think is going to be the resource issue of the 21st century, I'd be very happy to try and help him.
And perhaps maybe he might like to join in on a discussion about that down the road.
Well, we certainly could do that because, as I say, the major water diversion schemes in on the North American continent, that there are five major diversions of water out of Canada into the U.S., and there's all sorts of interesting situations. And I say I taught a water resources class for 25 years, so I dealt with the city of Winnipeg at the municipal level about pricing of water, availability of water, metering of water, metering of sewage, because you've got to get a control of the water coming in and the water going out. And any of those things, I'd be very happy to discuss it with him.
And once again, I'd just like to thank Dr. Ball for joining us again. It's always extremely informative, and since we're now furloughing our students out here in California for 2 days out of the month, what the creative solution I have is ask my students to listen to one of our interviews and then write a little summary of it, so this does have an educational value for them. And thanks to you, Melody, for hosting this, and I appreciate the mayor coming along and offering his perspectives, which I thought were very, very good. So thank you all for, I think, a very interesting interview. This is a very complex topic, and obviously we could keep talking about it, but I think we've covered a lot of good points.
Well, gentlemen, thank you. This was a really fun 2 hours for me. And it's pretty exalted company in terms of the education and knowledge, and I really appreciate being part of it. And I would keep your voices up, and you will be heard eventually. I have little doubt in that. Melody, thanks for putting this together.
And thank you.
Okay.
And bye-bye. Goodbye.
Here we go. My pleasure.
This is why I told her, I said, I'm not doing all this other stuff.
Well, it's all mine.